All right, diving right in today. We're going where legal lines get blurry. Native American treaty rights butting heads with federal conservation laws. We're using a case, United States v. Dion. This one really shows how tough it is to balance, you know, keeping those old promises from treaties and the government having to protect species, especially eagles in this case.
Yeah, Dion, it's like a landmark, right? It's essential reading for anyone getting into federal Indian law, especially when you see how laws passed by Congress can sometimes just overrule rights set out in treaties. It really gets to the core of how much power Congress has.
So let's set the scene here. Dwight Dion Sr., part of the Yankton Sioux tribe, he's hunting bald eagles on their reservation, lands them in hot water with the feds, ends up convicted under the ESA, that's the Endangered Species Act, for killing those bald eagles. More convictions piled on under BPA, Bald Eagle Protection Act, and the MBTA, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, for selling eagle parts. Interesting side note, a charge about a golden eagle that was under BPA got tossed out early by the district court.
The interesting bit for law students, or anyone who likes how legal arguments work, is that Dion wasn't saying, "Oh, I didn't know." His defense, it hinged on the 1858 treaty between the U.S. and the Yankton Sioux. They said that guaranteed their hunting rights. So the big legal question became, did Congress, by passing BPA and the ESA, basically wipe out that treaty right to hunt eagles?
And that's a huge question when you think about how treaties and later laws interact, right? It makes you wonder how far Congress can go in passing laws that might clash with existing treaties with tribes. It's a delicate balancing act, for sure, like we said, between respecting tribal sovereignty and the government's duty to protect nature.
Exactly. And the stuff laid down in Dion, it doesn't stop at eagle hunting. The implications are much broader, impacting how any treaty right is interpreted when a federal law comes along that seems to contradict it. Dion really pushes the boundaries of what Congress can do with these agreements.
So, why should you, the listener, care about United States v. Dion? Well, stick with us on this deep dive, and you'll come away with a solid grasp of the clear and plain standard for treaty abrogation, a cornerstone of federal Indian law. We'll also break down how courts dig into a law's history to figure out what Congress really meant when they passed it, especially if it affects treaties. By the end, you'll have a much better understanding of the whole tribal sovereignty versus federal law thing, and it is complicated.
Absolutely. For those aiming for a law career, getting Dion is like getting a key tool. It helps you analyze not just these old legal battles, but also what's happening today with tribal rights and federal rules. It's
Yeah.
all connected.
Okay, let's get into the nitty-gritty of this case. We've got the facts, the main legal issue. What were the specific legal points the Supreme Court wrestled with to reach their decision?
Well, the heart of it, as we've touched on, was whether Congress actually erased the Yankton Sioux's treaty right to hunt eagles when they passed BPA and the ESA. A separate but related question was, even if that treaty right was gone, could Dion still use it to defend himself against the charges?
And how does a court even begin to untangle that? Treaties are a big deal in the legal world. How can a law that comes later just undo them?
That's where the clear and plain standard comes in. The Supreme Court, in Dion, they doubled down on the standard, referenced a major case, Lone Wolf v. Hitchcock. It's a cornerstone in Indian law. The idea is Congress has to be super obvious, unmistakable if they want to do away with the treaty right. Courts don't just assume a general law overrides a specific treaty. You got to have solid evidence that Congress looked at those treaty rights and consciously chose to set them aside.
So the court's looking for really strong signs that Congress meant to overrule this specific treaty, right? What kind of evidence did they look at with BPA?
The details of BP added a lot. It generally says no taking, keeping, or selling bald or golden eagles. But there's a part that lets the Secretary of the Interior give permits for these things, including permits for Native American religious practices. The court zeroed in on this permit system. Their thinking was, if you need a permit, even for religious stuff, it wouldn't make sense if there was still this open-ended treaty right to hunt eagles. Needing a permit meant Congress wanted to control all eagle hunting, treaty, or no treaty, according to the court.
So the court saw the permits as basically contradicting the idea of an unlimited right to hunt eagles that existed before. It's like saying, yeah, you've got this right, but only if we say so.
Exactly. The court saw that permit part as a clear sign, even if it wasn't spelled out, that Congress was taking charge of all eagle hunting, and that meant overriding any old treaty rights that might have been there.
Did the court go beyond the actual text of BPA? I mean, what if that permit system was just about conservation in general, not targeting treaty rights?
Great question. And that brings us to the role of legislative history. It was crucial here. The court dug into the debates, reports, all the paperwork around BP's creation. What'd they find? Evidence that Congress knew how important eagles were to tribes, culturally and religiously, and that hunting them mattered. But the main focus was clear: conserving bald and golden eagles. When they were working on the law, Congress chose the permit system to balance things out: conservation on one side, tribal needs on the other. For the court, that careful choice, making a permit system that dealt with religious use, meant they decided not to let a completely free treaty right to hunt just keep going.
So even though BP didn't literally say, "We're overriding the Yankton Sioux Treaty," the court figured that out from how the law was set up with the permits and from the discussions and thinking that went on when it was being made.
You got it. The court said, yeah, a clear statement from Congress saying they're getting rid of a treaty right is the best evidence. But you can also see what they meant from clear and reliable evidence in the history of the lawmaking, especially if that history shows Congress knew their proposal might clash with treaty rights, and they decided to resolve it by ending those rights.
Got it. That explains their take on BPA. What about the ESA? How did that factor into the final call?
Well, once the court decided BP already nixed the Yankton Sioux's treaty right to hunt bald eagles, their logic on the ESA was pretty simple. They basically said, look, if that treaty right is gone, erased by BPA, then Dion can't use it as a shield against the ESA charges for the same exact thing, killing bald eagles. In other words, the ESA, which bans harming endangered species across the board, applied to Dion like everyone else. His special treaty exception was gone.
So the order matters. BPA took away the treaty right first. Then the ESA's general rules applied to Dion because his treaty protection was gone.
Exactly. BPA getting rid of that treaty right was the key. It meant the ESA could apply without being challenged based on the treaty in this case.
Now, this has big implications for the power dynamic between the federal government and tribes. What did Dion change looking beyond this one case?
Dion really hammered home Congress's plenary power over tribal stuff. Basically, that's the huge authority the federal government has when it comes to Native American tribes. The decision underlined that while treaties are serious legal deals, Congress can still override them with later laws. But Congress has to be clear about wanting to do that, even if they don't say it right in the treaty itself. Dion set a precedent. Courts got to look closely at how a law is built and its history to see if treaty rights have been taken away. This means even if a law doesn't directly name a specific treaty, courts can still decide those rights are gone if the whole context around that law's creation strongly suggests that's what Congress wanted.
And what does that do to the idea of tribal sovereignty? It seems like that could weaken those sovereign rights.
That's a really important point. Dion definitely brings up big questions about how strong and secure tribal sovereignty is in the long run. While the court said treaty rights matter and you need a clear intention to get rid of them, they were okay with figuring that intention out from the history of how the law was made. They didn't insist on Congress writing it out clearly in the law itself. Some might say that makes treaty rights easier to chip away at or override in the future when the government has new goals, maybe something like environmental protection. It shows how tricky it is to balance what the federal government wants to do with the inherent rights and self-governance of Native American tribes. That struggle is still going on.
Okay, let's sum up United States v. Dion. The Supreme Court basically said the Bald Eagle Protection Act did cancel out the Yankton Sioux's treaty right to hunt bald and golden eagles. So Dwight Dion Sr. couldn't use his Yankton Sioux treaty rights as a defense against those ESA charges for killing bald eagles.
That's the main takeaway, yes. The court decided that BPA having a permit system and the discussions around it when it was made showed Congress's clear and plain intent to end that treaty right, even though the Yankton Sioux treaty wasn't directly mentioned in BPO. They based this on solid legal ground, like Lone Wolf v. Hitchcock, which backed up Congress's power in this area.
And the big lesson for anyone trying to understand this part of the law is how important that clear intent standard is and how courts figure out what it means. Often they look beyond the actual words of the law to see the bigger picture, like what Congress was trying to achieve and what they considered.
Exactly. Dion is a prime example of how the history of a law's creation can be the key to figuring out what a law means and how it impacts treaty rights. It also shows how complex and sometimes messy federal Indian law and natural resource protection can be, with all their conflicting priorities.
This has been a really eye-opening deep dive into United States v. Dion. It definitely sheds light on a critical point where very different legal principles and societal values clash.
I agree. It's a case that still matters today and continues to shape how the law deals with Native American treaty rights and how far federal power reaches.
So as you, the listener, think about what Dion decided, here's something big to consider. The Supreme Court was willing to conclude that a treaty right was gone based on the history of the Bald Eagle Protection Act. What does that mean for the safety and scope of other Native American treaty rights? Especially when they might bump up against new things the government cares about or wants to do. How might this balancing act between tribal sovereignty and federal power keep changing in the future? Especially with new problems and priorities popping up all the time, it's a complicated issue with long-lasting effects that's worth thinking about.